This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Ajamu Baraka about the ongoing racial crisis across the nation.
Can it be stopped with better civilian review boards, more training of the cops, or is something deeper at play? Crisis of capitalism, racism, and white supremacy.
We'll talk about a landmark victory on climate change that took place in the Netherlands.
For the first time, climate change is looked at as a violation of human rights, and a state, in this case the Netherlands, is forced to do something about it.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, last week it was front page news all over the world, the deal with Iran over nuclear weapons. But I understand you have a different take to the usual debate on this.
Well, look, do I think it's a good thing that we made a deal about it? Absolutely. Do the Iranians think it's a good thing because they've had these punitive sanctions on them since 1979 will be lifted? Is that a good thing? Yes, of course that's a good thing.
But Israel's not happy about this.
Right. Well, Israel is interesting about this because Israel is just, you know, they're never going to be happy about it because they want to remain the only nuclear power in the Middle East. Not that Iran was necessarily going to be building a nuclear bomb.
Right.
No one's ever proved that,
right.
I should say. But Israel's not happy because they think it's too soft on Iran. But let's look at this from another way. So everybody's saying this is fantastic. What a great thing. Obama diplomacy is.
Well, everyone except the conservatives.
Right. Obama is doing okay with this. He's done great on diplomacy rather than bomb Iran.
Right.
And of course, we all think that's good. But I look at it as both types of U.S. imperialism. One is what we call the metal glove or the metal
hard
hand.
Fist.
Which is the U.S. punitive bombings from Obama to Bush, whether it's Iraq or Libya, et cetera. Let's send our military forces, let's bomb it, and let's take over the country. And then there's the soft hand, which is what we call the soft glove imperialism. And isn't that really what this is in a certain way? Because here's what the U.S. is getting out of it. They're getting out of it. They don't have to use the military to do it. They're making sure, if that was ever really the problem, that Iran will not get a bomb, which means that Israel will remain the only nuclear power in the Middle East with 200 bombs. And I would ask you, and we all may have different answers, but who would you trust more with the bomb? The people who just killed 2,500 people in Gaza, 500 children, or the Iranians? I think that's, I won't say it's a close question. I don't trust the Israelis at all with 200 bombs. Not one second. If they feel threatened, whether they're really threatened, they will use the nuclear weapons.
Right.
There's to me no issue about that.
Agreed.
So if I look at this one way, what the U.S. was able to do is to force Iran to stop a nuclear program, not necessarily to build a bomb, but to limit what it could do with uranium. So the U.S. is still dominating the Middle East and dominating Iran while leaving Israel completely alone. Now, there's ways you could do something here. The Non-Proliferation Treaty on Nuclear Weapons, the U.S. could simply say, we're going to sanction Israel until they sign the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Israel has never really openly admitted they have a bomb, but everybody knows it, and they've practically admitted it. So why don't they do that? Or you could say, let's sanction Israel until they get out of the occupied territories. But none of them did that. And then let's go back to the origins of the sanctions. I mean, sanctions are being done, in this case, were being done by an imperial country, the United States. They started in 79 and 80. What happened in 79 and 80? Well, let's remember what happened in 1953. The U.S. overthrew the only democratic leader of Iran, Mossadegh, and replaced him with the Shah of Iran, who they supported through 1979, while his forces disappeared people, murdered people, and killed them. And then what happens is they overthrow him, or he gets sick, supposedly, and who takes him in? The United States takes him in to give him medical treatment, and that's when the Iranians took over the U.S. embassy. You know, what you're talking about here is continuous U.S. interference in Iranian politics. And if you're sitting there with Iran, and the U.S. has already overthrown one government, taken in a dictator from another government, and then put sanctions on you, I'm not saying they're building a bomb or were, but for your own security, you might want to think about it, especially with Israel, a mortal enemy in Israel's eyes, having 200 atomic bombs. So I think all this hoopla and everything is Sure, it's important, but in the end, we're really talking about a U.S. softer imperialism dominating the politics and what another country can do, in this case, Iran.
And also having dual standards, depending on, you know, the Israel standard and other countries.
Right. You'd call it dual standards. Right. That's correct. I mean, they're just completely hypocritical standards. There's no standards at all. It's just saying Israel's too powerful in terms of our own country, too many people who support it.
Right.
They're essentially our, Chomsky said, is our, I think it was Chomsky, our aircraft carrier in the Middle East. It's armed to the teeth by the United States, and we're not going to force them to do anything. But a country that may be able to create some counterweight to Israel in the Middle East, we're going to force to step down its nuclear program, and we're going to force inspectors on it. On the other hand, it is a victory for the people of Iran in the sense that there's no longer sanctions, and they'll be able to thrive as a country, which they have been to a certain extent anyway. And as you said, Heidi, it is the right wing that opposes this, but that's because what's been defeated here is not imperialism. What's defeated here is military right-wing imperialism that wants to bomb a country.
Right.
In that sense,
they
want
to take the hard approach.
In that sense, this is right. But people shouldn't be fooled for a second that this is another form of imperialism.
Michael, I was up at Central Park recently. There are 22 statues of men in that park. Did you know that?
And only men.
Right. No women.
No women. Well, there are some women. I think Alice in Wonderland.
Oh,
right. The
correct.
Other the other statues are all of people who've supposedly...
Real people.
Right, real people and contributed significantly to our society or not. They're real people. The others, they think they have one Alice in Wonderland. And they have Balto the dog, but that's not a woman. And then they may have Cinderella or something like that.
Right, a fantasy figure.
Right, so there's the point is there's no women statues
Who
in Central Park.
Who pointed this out?
Well, there's been a campaign for a number of years to try and get women placed into the park.
Right.
So the other day...
The park is safe enough now to have women
put the
in there.
Women, even if they're statues, right? Well, I don't know if Balto the dog is going to attack people.
Right.
But anyway, Balto, meanwhile, is the dog who took the penicillin or some drug in Alaska. He was a sled dog to rescue some person.
Oh, right, yeah.
Anyway, that's
Balto.
But in any case, so now the proposal is, which is looking toward it's going to be approved, and the Times put an article up, to put two statues in the park of Katie Stanton and Susan B. Anthony.
Right.
And those are two very famous women suffragettes.
Exactly.
People who fought for women's votes.
Yeah, but were they New Yorkers?
Yes,
they were.
Not New Yorkers, but they all have, quote, a relationship to New York. So I thought that was great, a good idea. But then I asked myself, you know, there's two white women.
Good point.
And as far as I know, the 22 statues are all white. I don't think there's any blacks.
Right.
There's one black that I read when I looked through the list quickly, and that's Frederick Douglass, the famous abolitionist.
Mm-hmm.
His statue, though, doesn't really make it into the park. It's at the intersection of 110th Street and Central Park in the traffic circle, and it's
right in the traffic circle.
Right at the edge of the park, but not in the park. So I think it's true of this. There's no black women in the park.
Right.
That's 100% because there's no women.
Yeah.
Secondly, there may be no black men in the park.
Wait, Michael, isn't Duke Ellington in the park?
I think so. I think that's right. Now we have Frederick Douglass on the northwest corner, and I think Duke Ellington on the northeast corner. So that's at least something. But there's no black women in the park.
Right.
And in terms of indigenous people, I looked through the list, and there
None.
Is one, actually.
Oh.
But not it's a generic indigenous person.
What's
it's not,
that mean?
It's an indigenous person in a loincloth.
Oh, but
hunting with a bow and arrow.
No,
they doesn't have a name.
Oh,
no, it's just
goodness.
An indigenous person. So I'm thinking now they're going to put two white women in the park.
Right.
Why don't we at least put a black woman in the park?
I agree.
And think about it. We could either do one white woman and one black woman, or we could do three people.
Right.
And there are at least two people I thought of. Both were women's rights advocates, and both were former slaves, and both are very important and tied to New York history. Sojourner Truth, in particular, a slave from Ulster County, argued a famous case to free her son, and wrote the incredible speech, or spoke it, called Ain't I a Woman?
Great idea.
Which I'm sure we've all heard.
Yep.
And so why, if they're going to do Susan B. Anthony and Katie Stanton, why don't they also do Sojourner Truth? And the third or fourth person they could do is Harriet Tubman.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Harriet Tubman, people associate mostly with the South and other places. But in fact, Harriet Tubman not only ran part of the Underground Railroad, freeing some 70 slaves or more, but she also was a women's rights advocate and a suffragette, no less. And she also did have a tie to New York, in the sense that at some point after the Civil War. She lived in New York when I presume she was arguing for the rights of women to vote.
So we cover many bases.
Right. So I find it really, as Ajamu said on an interview we did with him, you know, white supremacy just goes through the heart of this country. And even when it comes to deciding what people we're going to put in Central Park, and yes, we do have to absolutely get that park up to 50-50, certainly,
right,
with women and men. But we also have to think about the fact that black women and slaves particularly played a huge historical role, an important role in the history of this country and the history of this city.
Michael, I think this is a crucial campaign. I do. I think this should gain traction.
In our coverage of the ongoing racial crisis in the United States, we speak with Ajamu Baraka, a human rights activist, organizer, and geopolitical analyst. He's an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, editor and contributing columnist for the Black Agenda Report, and a contributor to Killing Trayvons, an anthology of American violence. Ajamu, welcome to Law and Disorder.
My pleasure to be here.
Ajamu, it's actually great to have you. We've been hearing and listening to a lot of what you've been saying. In fact, my son saw you at the Philadelphia Social Forum. You've been all over the place lately.
Right. The last 6 weeks, yeah.
Well, more than that, but it's really nice to have you on. Ajamu, let's start with the first question, and then we'll go to a lot of other things, but a broad question. As we go from Ferguson to Cleveland to Baltimore to Charleston, pick a city, we're seeing murders of black young men in particular. And, of course, there's different takes on it from different people, but we really wanted to have you on because we just think your judgment on these issues and what you have to say is so important. So can you give us some context for how you're thinking about these?
Well, you know, I'm trying to engage folks in a understanding of the social and historical context for this intensified violence, both state and non-state violence directed at the African-American community, primarily the African-American working class community and the sub-working class, if you will, communities. And for me, the analysis has to be placed within the context of the continuing crisis of capitalism and the intensification of white supremacist ideology that's being reflected not only in the policies of these state authorities, but also in the mentalities of the individuals who are policing in these communities. What I mean by that is this: we have a convergence of both the normalization of white supremacist ideals and the fact that these police agencies are being called on to police, to control and contain populations that at this moment in history are no longer important to the U.S. economy. These are, unfortunately, the economic reality in these black communities is that our populations have become almost economically redundant. So we are, in fact, what Du Bois talked about or raised the question about almost 100 years ago, we are a social problem. And the way that the state appears to be prepared to deal with this social problem is through intensified policing and mass incarceration. So, you know, young folks in particular, people in the Black Lives Matter movement, they need to understand that while we need to be responsive to these police killings, we've got to place this in a political context that gives it broader meaning than just being concerned about, quote-unquote, bad apples in the police forces.
In 2009, the Department of Homeland Security wrote a report citing the right-wing supremacist entities as a primary danger. And in fact, a lot of high-profile killings have been motivated by these right-wing groups. That report was suppressed.
Yes. Yeah, I talked about that in my last piece on this situation in Charleston, that here we had a warning connected to the fact that you had the Department of Homeland Security identifying this growing militant white nationalist movement as a grave internal threat to national security, if you will. But because of the opposition from the Republicans in the Congress, who claimed that this was a politically motivated report, that even John Boehner said that this was a report that was criticizing Americans who were just opposed to the direction that the Obama administration was taking the U.S. government, the Obama administration caved, and they basically pulled the report and eliminated that report from the website of the Department of Homeland Security. So in the black communities, instead of us being made aware of the fact that this was a concern on the part of the state, that didn't happen. If that would have happened, perhaps when that Dylann Roof showed up at that church, even though I'm sure he would have been welcome to come in, there may have been one or two people there who would have been very suspicious and would have watched them closer if we were made aware of the fact that this is a growing threat here in this country as a consequence of all of the things, and they talked about this in the report, the first black president and all of the kinds of racist appeals, both subtle and direct, being made to the white working class and to others, that this was creating this atmosphere of hate that was being expressed through these organized factions here in the U.S. So, you know, that was suppressed, and the consequence has been that when the burners did take place in Charleston, there was a real attempt on the part of the Obama administration to try to deflect attention away from the irresponsibility of the government, both his administration and Congress, and to depoliticize the attack, to domesticate it, to make it a individual criminal attack, as opposed to having people understand that this was part of a growing movement here in this country. It also had the effect, I think, in terms of domesticating and depoliticizing the attack, it eliminated the possibility of real solidarity for being expressed for people outside of the U.S., because instead of this being seen as a sort of a terrorist attack, it was seen as, again, an individual attack by a troubled young man. So it eliminated that potential political space for real solidarity from folks around the world.
John Mubaraka, you wrote an article for Counterpunch on President Obama's speech in Charleston.
Yes.
And you wrote, quote, "President Obama turned in one of the best performances of a lifetime of performances for white supremacy." What did you mean by that?
That his task was to go to Charleston and to complete the process of deflecting attention away from the state, to depoliticize the event, using his enormous talents to play at being a friend and ally to black folks and the black movement. He turned in a masterful performance. That he sung his Amazing Grace, written by this white slaver 2 centuries ago, and he made this an event that was uniquely American, with no political implications beyond this troubled individual. So it was, you know, that was what the system needed. They didn't want the embarrassment of having to deal with the fact that you have this homegrown terrorist movement in the U.S., and that was the performance he provided.
Well, as you travel around the U.S., and particularly, I know you were in the South recently, what kind of political consciousness and organization do you see coming to the fore?
Well, you know, there is, fortunately, his performances aren't as effective as they were 7 years ago. So there are some, many, who recognize that there are some real concerns that we have to begin to address within the black community regarding the vulnerability that we have vis-a-vis state police forces and these vigilante and right-wing groups. So there is an understanding that we need to deal with that issue. We need to also understand objectively what we are facing economically in this country. And so there is a growing political consciousness. But it's still difficult to completely develop because of the effectiveness of the Obama administration in alignment with the members of what we call the Black Misleadership Class to deflect attention, to depoliticize events, and to direct a lot of the potential oppositional energy back into more accommodationist politics, you know, connected to the Democratic Party. But there is a lot of things in play right now within the Black community politically. And we see with, you know, Black Lives Matter movement and other, the Black Left Unity Network and other efforts, there's real motion that's taking place within the Black community. And I think there's a real recognition among many people also that until there's a strengthening of the radical Black movement in this country, and that movement becoming more and more of a centralized component of oppositional politics in the U.S., then the entire progressive movement itself is not going to make the kind of progress that the historical conditions are potentially providing for us.
I've noticed, and I'm sure you have as well, that with this emerging and strengthening of the radical Black community, countervailing forces arise as well. In New York City, we've added, I think, 1,400 police officers to the force. Mayor de Blasio, in the wake of the settlement in the Eric Garner case, said all lives matter, Black lives matter, Blue Lives Matter, referring to law enforcement, reflecting, I think, some of the pressures from the police unions.
Yes.
What do you think of that sort of commensurate tamping down of the emerging Black movement?
Well, I mean, it was understandable and typical of a liberal sentiment. It gives the impression with the settlement that the state can be responsive to these kinds of killings. And it's effective in the sense that there's some that still believe that there are reforms that can be achieved within the existing state, within on both the national and the local level regarding how the police forces operate. But the conditions that people are facing and the fact that these murders continue, those individual cases like Eric Garner and the settlement with the authorities in New York are not going to be enough to counteract the growing perception that war is being waged against Black and poor people here in this country. So this struggle of perception, the struggle of around ideals and understanding continues and intensifies. While we have this movement towards sort of an accommodationist understanding or perception of politics in the U.S., again, being driven by many young people, there's this understanding that's taken hold in many parts of the Black community that what we're up against is something much deeper than just the individual cases like Eric Garner or Walter Scott or you name it.
We're sitting here thinking, are we left after all of this, what they took the flag down in South Carolina? Or there's going to be discussions about getting a more effective civilian police review board? Where do we go from here?
Well, we have to engage those conversations because one of the marvelous results of the Obama administration's response to the murders in Charleston was to encourage the conversation around the symbols of white supremacy and in particular the Confederate flag, as opposed to a real serious understanding or at least some degree of conversation. And exposure to the fact that you have this growing right-wing movement and the growing normalization of racism in the U.S. Yes, these sort of reforms, strengthened civilian review boards, more federal intervention, they're going to be pushed. But because of the objective inner logic of the capitalist crisis at this moment in history, those kinds of behaviors are going to remain, and they're going to get worse. And because of that, that provides opportunities for serious political discussion and education in our communities so that we have a better and more sophisticated understanding of what it is we're up against. So there's no doubt that these kind of reforms are going to be pushed by the black misleadership class and the professional and managerial elite within the black community, and even among some, you know, liberals. But there's a growing understanding that we've got to begin to really come to terms with a radical analysis that will help us to understand where we need to strategically concentrate ourselves, our efforts, our oppositional efforts, moving toward the kind of politics we have to develop in this country that's going to get to the core of the real issues. And that is that ultimately, if we're not talking about the radical transformation of this society, the elimination of this repressive state, the elimination of this economic system that's causing so much misery both in the U.S. and globally, then we are, in fact, sort of BSing the people and playing right into the hands of the reformists and the individuals and movements that are trying to obscure the reality that we're up against.
Yeah, no, I think that's really astute and really appreciate the comment. As we close this, I want to go back to how you opened this interview a little bit and what you've talked about a bit as we've gone along, which is what you called the crisis of capitalism, the fact that there's a class in the United States that is no longer of use to the society, and that crisis and that combination and some other factors, white supremacy, are intensifying the repression of black people in the United States. And I'm interested in how you relate that to, or if you think, there's perhaps a world crisis now of capitalism that's creating these contradictions, and we can't really predict how it's going to come out, and what you would say to that.
Of course. I mean, when we talk about the crisis of capitalism, we're not talking about the U.S. We're talking about the global phenomenon. And we saw some of the manifestations of it a few days ago with the stock market collapse in China. And we're seeing it played out in the struggle between Greece and the European Central Bank, IMF, and the European Commission. But basically, there are some serious global issues. We see it being played out with the economic contradictions we see in the so-called BRIC nations. This is one structural reality we have to deal with. And the crisis in the U.S., is manifesting itself in certain ways. And again, when I go back to the black community, one of the consequences of the restructuring of the economy in the U.S. Has been that basically low-wage, low-skilled labor that is really representative of black labor has become almost redundant. And that is the issue we have. So, you know, we've got to deal with those structural realities. We've got to deal with what that means in terms of the kinds of ideals that are being generated by the ruling class to keep us confused and divided. Because if we don't deal with white supremacy and all of its manifestations, then it's going to continue to be the Achilles heel of the progressive and revolutionary movement in the U.S. And so we've got to have serious conversations, even when those conversations are uncomfortable. You know, we've got to talk about what this means. We've got to talk about what this means in terms of the growing Latino movement here in this country. We've got to talk about what this means in terms of the sort of nonprofit industrial complex and how they continue to be able to fragment our movement and to feed into opportunism and careerism. You know, we've got to have some serious struggles, because the moment at this time in history is so critical that if we don't solve these problems, then basically we're not going to take advantage of the weaknesses of the ruling class at this moment. But in terms of how that's going to play out, there's a real good possibility that it's going to move further and further and more aggressively toward the right. And we see that all over the world.
On that note, Ajamu, we so appreciate your insights. It's always really a pleasure to have you joining us, especially on this topic.
Thank you very much. It's been amazing to watch over the last couple of years, Ajamu, and really appreciate it.
Thanks, Ajamu. Looking forward to seeing you in New York.
Bye-bye.
Yes,
bye-bye.
Too. Bye-bye. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Got a story I wanna tell somebody. I've seen a lot of things go down. I was the third brother of five, doing whatever I had to do to survive. I'm not saying what I did was all right. Trying to break out of the ghetto was a day-to-day fight. Been down so long, getting up didn't cross my mind, but I knew there was a better way of life, and I was just trying to find. You don't know what you would do until you put under pressure.
There's a new development in litigation and climate change, and this is really the first good one we've had. It took place in the Netherlands, and today we have with us two experts on that opinion, Eleanor Stein from the United States and Alex Geert Castermans from the Netherlands. Eleanor Stein is an energy and environmental lawyer who specializes in climate change. She teaches the law of climate change in Albany Law School and at the State University of New York. She's on the board of Ecoviva, a U.S. group in solidarity with rural sustainability and climate adaptation in El Salvador, and she is currently completing an LLM in international climate change law at Strathclyde University in Glasgow. Alex Geert Castermans is a professor of private law at Leiden University. He is interested in the interaction between European law and Dutch private law. His human rights writings include exploration of the legal liability of the Dutch parent companies for subsidiaries' involvement in violation of fundamental internationally recognized human rights, including environmental rights. Eleanor and Alex, welcome to this show, and a special show on an important climate verdict or decision that just took place in the Netherlands. So let's start with you, Eleanor. Almost no one, I'm sure, in the United States knows anything about this case, the issues, etc. Why don't you tell us what decision was made and why it's important, and then let's hear from Alex.
It's nice to be here again. So this is a really groundbreaking decision by a court in the Netherlands. It's called Urgenda against the state of the Netherlands. And in this decision, this is basically the first time that a court has ordered a state to take more aggressive action on the issue of climate change. There have been cases where the advocates, you know, against climate change have won, but they have been based on interpretation of statute. And this case was really based on the interpretation of science, first of all, played a major role, the interpretation of the European Convention on Human Rights, and interpretation of the Constitution of the Netherlands, and then general principles of private law or negligence law, and finding that the state of the Netherlands had a duty of care to its citizens, and that it had breached that duty of care by failing to live up to its obligations under the climate treaties and obligations it had undertook in an earlier period.
And Alex, you're Dutch. What's your take on this case?
I think I agree with Eleanor. That's a remarkable case. Although we know the courts in The Hague, the courts of first instance and the Court of Appeals are really prepared to give opinions of a very severe kind towards the government. They're very critical on the government's actions. They did some pretty good cases before, for example, in the case of Srebrenica, or in the case of discrimination of women in politics. So they are very keen in doing very groundbreaking decisions. And I think this is one in line with what they did before.
I'm curious, in the United States, for cases like this, we often have a groundswell of activists supporting or drawing attention to this. Did you have the equivalent of that from sort of the public?
Yes, I think the Urgenda Association has been very active in gaining support for the climate change issue, as did the academic group that formulated the Oslo principles just in time, because at the time of the hearings in The Hague, a group of academics issued the so-called Oslo principles, calling upon state governments to take more firm action with regard to climate change.
So, Eleanor, Alex, what's going to happen as a result of this decision?
Well, the decision was, and we can go back and I can tell you about the claims, but essentially, the holding of the court was that the government of the Netherlands had failed in its duty of care, it breached its duty of care, and that it had to adopt a more aggressive target of 25% reduction of greenhouse gases below 1990 levels by 2020. They had to reach that target by 2020. Currently, they're operating on a roughly 20% target. So the court, really for the first time, a court has ordered a state to increase its aggressiveness in its treatment of greenhouse gas emissions. It's very clear. It states that it not only has to change its target, but it has to monitor and implement aggressively these accomplishments over the next 5 years. That is a new artifact in the world of climate change law, and people have been trying for a generation to have a court take an action of that kind.
The order is not very specific, though. It doesn't say what the state actually has to do, but be more aggressive towards combating climate change. And this could be a serious problem, because when we are in 2020, how do we find out whether the state lived up to its obligations? I think that's a very hard thing to cover.
I think it's a hard thing to establish, but it's also true that the United Nations has a huge secretariat, a climate secretariat, which is dedicated to monitoring compliance with the Kyoto targets and to measuring greenhouse gas emission reductions, and also the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the World Science Organization, has a measurement, methods and metrics. But it certainly is difficult to establish, because you can make reductions in certain areas, and if the people of the Netherlands buy twice as many cars in the next 5 years, you can find that you failed to meet your target, even though you've, let's say, closed all your coal plants. So it's a squishy target. All of these are squishy targets, and that's one problem with basing a climate regime on targets in the first place.
But let me ask you, I'm trying to understand. They have to reduce CO2 and greenhouse gases by a certain amount by 2020, but how does the state go about that? Do they close coal plants? What do they do? Who implements it? How do they determine anything?
Well, every government that is part of the Kyoto Protocol and every government that has any kind of climate change plan has a series of measures underway to reduce emissions. So you could start with the power sector, the energy sector, and stop the use of coal. If you do that, you would cut greenhouse gas emissions enormously, pretty much immediately. But of course, you have to have some alternatives ready to go, because people are still going to want to turn on the lights. So it's easy to say, close all the coal plants, but not quite so easy to do. And you can raise the emission standards for automobiles. This is something that the EPA has done in the United States. You can change the standards for all kinds of, industrial machinery, all kinds of appliances to make them more energy efficient. You can ban incandescent bulbs, as New York has done, and I think the U.S. has done. Replace all the lighting. It's very well established that it is possible to make these cuts.
It's true, and I think that the Dutch are behind with respect to solar energy, for example. In Germany, they are far more ahead with that. So
they have sunshine in the Netherlands?
Yes, they have sunshine in the Netherlands.
They have it in Germany.
And we have a lot of wind. So
wind, I know you have.
You have the first windmills probably in the world.
Yeah, I guess.
Wind, it's interesting. One of the facts, this is a huge scientific record in this case, which is in and of itself significant. But one of the facts which I think had a huge impact on the court, and Alex Geert, tell me if you agree, it was looking at the per capita emissions, which are striking, because the U.S. is at about 20 metric tons of greenhouse gas per year per person. China is at 9, even though China has almost twice the amount of emissions in absolute terms, but in per capita terms, they're about half the U.S. But the Netherlands is at about 13.
Where do you drive in the Netherlands? It's all canals, right?
And we are biking a lot. But
yes, I see bikes. I almost got hit by a bike the other day there. Yes. But let me ask a question about the underlying theory. I just read quickly about it, and it's this idea that somehow climate change and human rights are related. And if I think about it just a bit, it's obvious that if the climate goes really badly, how are you going to grow food? How are you going to get water? All kinds of human rights are affected by that, the right to make a living, all that. That's my gross way of saying it. But can you explain a little bit? Because I think one of the important parts of this decision is that equation in some way, either Alex or Eleanor,
right,
to start.
There are two sections of the European Convention on Human Rights that the court addresses, and they say they're not literally applicable, but they use these to inform the standards and to define the duty of care. And the first was the right to life, and the second was a right to family life and privacy and home life. And they're looking at these because they start with this scientific analysis, and they're looking at all the decisions by the international treaty organizations and the work of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and they're looking at the projections for the impact of climate change on life and civilization going out for the next 80 years or more. And what they found is that the projections are that at the business-as-usual case, if our societies do nothing different than what they've been doing, which is continue to increase the carbon burden of the atmosphere, the level of disruption to human society is going to be so egregious and so catastrophic that life as we know it in large parts of the world is really going to change profoundly. That is their lodestar, that what we're talking about here in terms of these targets is how can we, what do we do now to mitigate those effects and to keep the carbon loading of the atmosphere, they say, below 450 parts per million. As we know, Bill McKibben and many others, James Hansen and many climate scientists are saying we actually need to keep below 350. But we are now over 400 parts per million for the first time since in human time. So the first time in 800,000 years. In February, we went over 400. So they're looking at what would happen if we don't act and how profoundly that will influence the way people live.
Let me add one thing, Eleanor. Perhaps it's in the Dutch constitution that the state should care for the environment. So we regard it as, you could say, a constitutional right that the state will take the necessary measures to combat climate change.
We're speaking with two attorneys, two professors, and in fact, one is also a judge, Eleanor Stein from Albany, and Alex Kostermans from Holland. And we're speaking about the Urgenda victory against the state of the Netherlands.
Urgenda. Tell us what it is, one of you. What is Urgenda? Sounded like the word gender with an "er" in front.
It's the urgent agenda, I guess.
They made it up.
Urgent. Right. But I had a question. And my question is this. Are there any other similar cases as the Urgenda case in the pipeline?
Well, in a sense, there are, yes. One of the fascinating things about their claims was, I mean, they came in representing, they're an environmental advocacy organization, and they also had almost 900 co-petitioners with them. So, you know, Urgenda itself is kind of a mass organization. But part of their claim is that they are representing not only today's people of the Netherlands and the world, but also future generations. So they have, a lot of their co-petitioners are children. And part of their claim is that the government has an obligation under the principle of intergenerational equity, which is very deeply ensconced in the climate treaties and other parts of international law, to safeguard the environment and the climate, the atmosphere, for the benefit of future generations. And the court was very taken with that theory and referred to it quite a bit. And especially in the United States, there's a whole series of cases called the Atmospheric Trust Litigation, or ATL, which are cases that have been brought in all 50 states by miners claiming that the states have a duty of care to their citizens to under the doctrine of public trust to care for the resources of the state for the benefit of future generations. They failed in federal court, but they're sort of inching their way through the state court system. And Oregon is one of the foremost cases, and that case is on appeal now. And they're currently now relying on the Urgenda decision to bolster their case with the appellate courts in Oregon that state constitution, you know, creates a duty of care on the part of the state toward future generations. So we're going to see Urgenda used a lot in that context, for sure.
And Eleanor, I was going to ask, are you aware of other countries that might also be bringing similar litigation? Or Alex?
If I'm not mistaken, there are parallel cases in other European countries, several.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
I have a question about where this case stands right now. Is this the lowest general court that it was decided in? Does it then go up to the higher, if the Dutch government wants, to the higher courts? And because it relied in part on the European Convention, could the Netherlands take it into the European Court of Human Rights or a similar court?
This is the court of first instance, so there is a possibility that the state will go into appeal. It will decide in August, and I'm pretty sure that they will. They stayed up until now that they share the concerns and the goals of Urgenda, but the relationship between the court and the government, that's the real point that the government will discuss in appeals, I guess. They can go to the Court of Appeals, and that will be a whole new round. So even if the state is going to adjust its policy, it will be more aggressive. It can take that to the court, and the court will judge as it is at that moment. So I guess they will go into appeal and say what they are doing and perhaps be more articulated with regard to the other choices that they have to make. For example, combating an economic crisis. I think they've been sloppy at that respect. So there are these great choices that a government has to make. And then they can go into cassation to the Supreme Court of the Netherlands, and that will be a matter of law only. So they cannot submit any new facts. They have to limit the discussion with regard to the law itself. And the state will not be able to go to Strasbourg or to Luxembourg.
Could Urgenda go?
Yes, they could, actually, yeah. If they think that the European Convention on Human Rights has been breached, then they can go to Strasbourg.
Now, when we interviewed you, I don't remember when, Eleanor, but a few years ago, it was about a case before the American Commission on Human Rights about the Inuits. Mm-hmm. And in some way, I know you've written about it, and Alex as well, I'm sure, is aware of this case. But how does that case, which you ultimately, I think I would use the word lost at the American Commission, how does that relate to this case?
Well, I think there's a very important relationship. I mean, that was really the case that brought the plight of the Inuit and the situation of the Arctic to the attention of the world, with a brilliant job done by the Inuit themselves in organizing it and making it political movement, building a political movement around it, and preparing an Arctic climate impact assessment that, with a group of both Western scientists and indigenous elders, scientists, documenting the effect of climate change in the Arctic, which of course is twice as catastrophic as it is on the rest of the planet. And that case was dismissed by the Inter-American Commission after a couple of rounds on the grounds that on the grounds that they found no human rights violations. I think that the core problem in the Inuit case was that no one had established that a state had a duty of care. And so even though terrible things were happening to the Inuit, there was no accepted legal basis for a claim against a state. In this case, it was a claim against the United States. And as far as I know, the Urgenda decision is the first ever to establish that a state has a duty of care to its citizens and more broadly, to take aggressive action on climate change, especially a developed nation state, the nations that hold the primary responsibility for the problem. So this is a tremendous step forward from where we were in 2005 when the Inuit petition was dismissed.
So is it possible to revisit the Inuit petition?
I think, especially if this survives on appeal, but probably even sooner, I expect to see a real blossoming of human rights litigation based on this.
Yeah. What do you think, Alex?
Should we pay tribute to the people that drew up the Oslo principles, Eleanor?
Yeah, please do.
I think they did a marvelous job.
We know nothing about that. You have to assume that none of your listeners in this audience They think it has to do with Israel. I mean, you know, Palestine.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. Well, there are there's this group of academics and some legal practitioners that drew up principles with regard to climate change, and they said, let these principles be a source of inspiration for judges, for courts. And they regard, for example, the way how we define the obligations of the states, define the obligations of enterprises, and how we deal with these very grave legal issues that should be overcome. For example, the issue of causation. Every state could say, like the Netherlands, well, we only cause this small proportion of climate change, so why should we be held responsible? And these wonderful people said, well, if everybody's going to say that, nobody will be responsible in the end. And I think you can hear in the decision these principles. I think they were inspired, actually, by this document. Don't you agree, Eleanor?
I strongly agree. And what they did is really fascinating. And I will send the principles on to you. It's just a short document. And Michael Gerard, the head of the Climate Change Law Center at Columbia Law School, was one of the moving forces behind the Oslo principles. And there's, I think, like a 10-page document, which is the principles, and then there's a 250-page document with all of the authority behind it. And what they basically did is they're trying to kind of create law by synthesizing all the existing arguments and authorities and precedent for each of the major pillars, like this issue of responsibility or the issue of state duty to act, into one whole. And they're kind of creating a whole cloth out of all these patches and saying, you can rely on this. You have, this will be your backup. And I think that the idea was to kind of, you know, give some backbone to some judicial authorities to feel that they could act because they have this synthesis of the law. And I think this is a perfect example of the use of that document. And it's an interesting model, actually, and very, very persuasively done.
And we really hope that it will go to work in private law relationships so that we even can go to the large enterprises and hold them responsible as well. So I hope it will have the effect in these other relationships as well.
What we're talking about right now is the Urgenda case. And I want you to remind us, Alex or Eleanor, what it specifically said the Netherlands had to do. Was it a percentage? Was it simply, as you once said earlier, Alex, make great efforts? Was it actually some percentage of greenhouse gases they had to reach?
Yes, it's the percentage. Due to the relationship between the court and the government, I think the court cannot say what the government specifically has to do. So it leaves it up to the government to decide, to encourage science to do a better job, to encourage enterprises to do a better job. They have to reach a number.
And what's that
number? 25% with regard to the 1990s levels. So
they have to lower it by 25%.
They have to lower it by 25%, indeed.
By 2020.
Indeed. Yeah.
Okay. Now
they are currently operating under a plan to lower it by 20% by 2020.
Right. That's right. You mentioned that. Right.
So it's just another. Right. It's a huge
thing. Right.
And one of the things that you would recognize, Michael, is the there's a long discussion in the decision about what we would call in the U.S. system of the political question doctrine, the kind of separation of powers issue. And, of course, the state of the Netherlands said, basically, court, this is none of your business. This is the role of the legislature. This is the role of the executive. We are in negotiating in international fora. You are going to prejudice and hamper our ability to negotiate. These are financial decisions, things that courts have nothing to do with. And the court rejected that entirely, which is also quite unusual.
Well, it said you should have been more specific. If you have problems with reaching the 25%, just say us why it's not possible. And they didn't say it. So
interesting.
Well,
right. That's why Alex, fortunately or unfortunately, said they're going to do better on appeal.
I'm afraid so.
At least that's what he's afraid of. Another thing you talked about, Eleanor, which I just want to clarify in my own head what the number is. You gave a number of 20 for the United States, 13 for the Netherlands, and 9 for China. Is per capita what?
Tons of greenhouse gases emitted per year. Metric tons of greenhouse gases.
Per person.
Per person.
Per person. Per capita.
That's astonishing.
Right. So the U.S., of course, is way ahead, but the Netherlands, doing pretty, unfortunately, not that far away.
I will say, in an unusual defense of the United States, I will say that the oil emirates emit twice as much per capita as we do.
Oh, my gosh.
Qatar has, I think, 43 tons per capita.
Well, I'd like to point out that those are allies of the United States.
But what if we just focus on a place like North Dakota and fracking? What would come out? I mean, that's right. Those are bigger than the Emirates.
Is there any place you could actually point to say they're doing a good job?
Any country?
Yeah.
Nordic countries, perhaps?
Well, you know, I think Denmark has done a good job. I think Germany has done a good job, a very good job. These are countries, first of all, that have met their Kyoto obligations and that have very, very aggressive renewable energy programs. So wind and solar in Denmark are, I believe, the primary sources of electricity in those countries. And in Germany, 30% solar, and on a good day, they get up to 75% solar.
They have to close down a few coal mines.
They have to close down some coal mines.
Right, of course. Norway has to close down a bunch of oil wells, right?
Right.
I mean, so
do we all.
We have other problems. I mean, that's Norway's main export. But let me ask a question about support, because, as you said, there were 900 petitioners on this court case. And so there's obviously a fair amount of support, if not a lot of support, in the Netherlands. So I'd like a little more description about what's going to happen next. Are there going to be demonstrations around it, writings, whatever? And then what kind of things are there, any international support from climate change organizations around the world? And what kind of things do you need to actually push this to the next stage?
We can use this case in Paris. I think Paris is the next stop. In December of this year, there will be this large climate change conference. And I think that will be the moment to have the large demonstrations and say to the world, this is a nice example, please follow it.
If people want to know more about the Urgenda case, where can they go? What can they do?
The nice thing is that the Court of The Hague translated the decision on, I can't pronounce that in English, but it's www.rechtspraak.nl, but I think you can put it on your on your website. But that's nice. The Dutch court translated it, so you can all read the decision.
Wonderful. Or put in the word urgenda, which I did as we prepared for this. U-R-G-E-N-D-A, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yes.
Okay. The other place to look is there's a group called Our Children's Trust out of Oregon, which is a group that centralizes all the atmospheric trust litigation, and they're covering the Urgenda case very very carefully, and that's www.ourchildrenstrust.org.
Wonderful. Well, Alex and Eleanor, thank you so much for this decision, which I know you were all at least in some way involved, and for giving us the information about it. And for hopefully our children won't have to worry too much. Wow.
Congratulations.
You're right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Eleanor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Alex.
Or your new grandchild, Eleanor. Congratulations on that.
Bye-bye.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. So
take care.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.